lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how...
Dennis Smith with us. He's the author of A Decade of Hope, Stories of Grief and Endurance from 9/11 Families and Friends. He's a former New York City firefighter and founder of the Firehouse Magazine, the largest circulating magazine for firefighters in the world. He's the author of 15 books, including 4 bestsellers. Report from Engine Number 82 has sold over 3 million copies in 13 languages. And Report from Ground Zero debuted at number 2 in the New York Times bestseller list. He's maintained at the forefront of the first responder community following the attacks on the World Trade Center. He's published a number of op-ed pieces covering a wide array of post 9/11 issues and sites on the board of Tribute, the interim memorial of the World Trade Center. And let us say, Dennis, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so very much for asking me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Dennis, when we really come down to it, 9/11 is so critically important to the culture that we live in, the history of this country in and of itself. Have we given it enough attention? Have we given it enough attention in a way that really supports and honors it?
Well, you know, I do think that we have given it a lot of attention, and sometimes the attention was, the motivations for the attentions were mixed. And so consequently, since there is not a directly straightforward a view of 9/11 that the mythology, you know, will be a little mixed going forward. When I say that, I mean, I think people think, well, you know, the firefighters and the police officers and the Port Authority police officers who acted so valiantly and courageously and were killed, and all of those people who were in those buildings were killed. We're really uncertain as to where the problem that was causal in 9/11 resides.
Sure. By the way, Dennis, let me interrupt you for a minute, one of the most important things that we can really deal with, my goodness, my heart and everybody's heart goes out to those people who were killed. And it wasn't just an effect on the United States. They attacked a basically global economy with the kind of businesses that were in those buildings. But what about the survivors? What about those people who had to live on with that hurt in their heart and the losses that they sustained? Those are the people we should be concerned about, and those are the people we should have paid attention to.
Well, I think that we have paid attention to them, and certainly in this book, I sought to get a balanced view of those people. Don't forget there were 2,974 people killed, and so that's a lot of families. I had 25 interviews in this book, and I tried to balance it in religions and wealth and race, and so that you get a view of what generally all of those people went through. And what I came away with really was that these people were inspiring. They're people of great character. They decided that they weren't going to sit back in a closet and weep for the rest of their lives, that they were going to try to, create some betterment in the world around them. And so these stories, I feel, are very inspiring in that way. But, I mean, you're right, there is lots of grief and lots of suffering. And we talk about the 10th anniversary all the time, and it is a milestone date. But for these families, you know, I got to say, every day is the milestone. Every day is another day of absence. And it's very difficult for them.
I remember that day very well. As a matter of fact, I remember in the morning, I was up in Fairbanks, Alaska at the time, and I remember in the morning, I think it was 4 or 5 o'clock our time, you know, when it started, and I was watching, riveted to everything that was going on. That day I got to the radio station and did what I did, and then I came back. I was syndicated out of Arizona at the time, and I spent the entire day getting information and finding things out, and I was fine all the way up to the time, and I can even feel it now, that I got to some of the people that were actually had businesses there, some of the financial institutions, and the people that they had lost that day, and the confusion and the things that were going on. One woman also in the media that I was talking to, her husband was downtown. He was in New York City at the time, and she couldn't find him. So, you know, all of those things were going on. It is a morning and a day that I will never forget. Now, what about you? Where were you when this happened?
Well, I arrived there. I went down to a local firehouse as soon as I heard about it, and we commandeered a bus, about 14 other firefighters and I. And we asked the people on the bus to leave. It was very dramatic. And we took that bus down to Ground Zero. And as we were a few blocks away, literally, the second building fell down. And then, you know, I stayed there for 57 days. And, you know, of course, I wrote report from Ground Zero. And that gave me an understanding of that day, which I think is pretty comprehensive. And also it gave me a place and a time to develop a lot of very close friendships that have developed in the last 10 years. And those friendships then, you know, enabled me really to identify the right people to interview, the right 25 people to interview for this book, so that the book was meaningful.
Now, by the way, what was your takeaway? When I say what was your takeaway, when it was all over and done, through your eyes, what did it mean to you? What was the essence of the meaning of the entirety of the 9/11 incident?
Well, I mean, you know, aside from the fact that I lost so many people I knew, and I went to, you know, 30-odd funerals in 2 months, aside from the grief, my takeaway, I think it was that we were at war, and it was a turning point in the lives of everybody in the world. As you said before, the attack, you know, created financial chaos, but that's not why they attacked us. They didn't care about the financial chaos. What they cared about was killing a great number of Americans so that they could, you know, send that signal that they are dangerous, that they are hateful, that they hate us. To think with the death of bin Laden that Al-Qaeda is dead is a mistake. And so that's what I brought away. So I brought away, you know, after 9/11, I said to myself, Dennis, how much do you know about Islam and the history of Islam? And I realized it was pathetically little. So I went and, you know, and I read, starting with Bernard Lewis's books, I read probably 30 books on the history of Islam and the Quran as well, which I read several times, just to educate myself about why somebody could radicalize this religion and kill so many people with such wantonness, supposedly in the name of a god. It's got to be a really mean god, but that's what they claimed. So this is my own inadequacy, and I determined that if you're going to be prepared, I learned this in the emergency service business. You know, I worked in the busiest firehouse in the world for many years. So I've been in a lot of burning buildings in my life, and I learned that without preparation, without knowing what you're doing, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And this is why, when I recognized how little I knew about Islam, I really recognized that I was in trouble as a United States citizen.
No, by the way, when it comes down to it, you know, your own personal opinion, I'm so tired of, and there are so many people today tired of, if you say something, you know, you're a bigot, you're a racist, and you don't know anything. And it's a way to keep people quiet and not being able to express. That's the one thing we have in this country, or had, was the ability to express. What is your feeling of, and you know this is going to probably come up tonight, but what is your feeling about a mosque being built right there at the center of all that horror?
Well, let me tell you, there are a couple of things, if I could tell you. You know, I could speak for several hours on the subject. The Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of England, in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, said that people should recognize that Islam is the number one problem facing the world, and the number two problem facing in the world that everyone is afraid to talk about, the number one problem.
Yeah.
And he's right. You know, we have a political correctness that is not entirely wrong. You know, I mean, I think we have to be considerate of people, and we can't just make blanket statements about 1.5 billion people living in the world who practice a certain religion.
Sure.
You have to look very carefully at the founding, going back to the Islamic Brotherhood and those kinds of things. But we are not adequately understanding the nature of Islam. When that mosque was first proposed by Imam Ruif, his father was a known member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Not that the apple it falls close to the tree, or you should be responsible for your father's actions, but he was, and that's known. Ruif announced the building of a mosque there, two blocks north of the North Tower of the World Trade Center. It was then resented by a great many people because what everyone failed to recognize in this was that over 1,200 people had never been found, not a fingernail, not a single piece of body to DNA. And where are those bodies? I mean, I was there that morning. You know, I spent the whole morning there and that whole day and that whole night. And so where were they? They were in the air. And where was the air? The air was where it fell. You know, that dust is where those bodies fell. And to build a mosque in that area was just grossly insensitive and arrogant. And the mayor came out and defended it in, I thought, the most pretentious way, you know, standing in front of the Statue of Liberty and talking about freedom. And no one ever denied their right to build that mosque. Never. I never heard a single person deny the right. What they said, what people were saying, is that this is really insulting to a great many families who have lost people in this attack by Muslim radicals. And to build a Muslim mosque in the same property where that air fell, where those 1,200 missing bodies were in the air, was just absolutely... And also, you know, there was a piece of the engine of the airplane was on the roof of that building when the airplanes crashed. So, it just is really terrible. And I wonder if the unions are going to build that building. I wonder if, you know, Imam Ruif is going to raise the money to build that building. It was 3 weeks later after there was such an outcry of resentment and outrage, really, of building this mosque that Imam Ruif decided not to call it a mosque any longer, but an Islamic cultural center.
Wonderful.
You know, that is the it just adds, this kind of hypocrisy just adds to the outrage.
Well, that's a slap. That part of it is truly a slap in the face. Dennis, we're just about out of time, but let me tell you, I'm totally on your side of the table with everything that you just said. It would have sounded like the words coming out of my mouth across the board. Now, let me ask you this. Website we can find you so we can buy the book.
Oh, I Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, I think. That's just look for Dennis Smith or A Decade of Hope.
Wonderful. Hey, Dennis, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Mike, for asking me. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be.
Tiffany Lynn Carroll's with us. She's the author of Shush, Smiles, Have Your Secrets Hidden. Tiffany was born February 13th, 1989, grew up in Dairy Farm outside small town with Bruxelles in Manitoba, and she loved spending years on the farm, learning more every day and working as a family to keep the farm growing. Now, she moved to Winnipeg, Manitoba for college, graduating with honors in tourism management at Red River College in 2010. She's currently working her way through towards a professional photography degree, enjoying every bit of knowledge that she gains. Her passions are reading, writing, photography, which consume most of her spare time when she's not spending weekends on the farm. This is her first published book and hopes to continue on with her writing dreams. And let's say, Tiffany, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. I got to tell you, you started a fight right before the show went on. I said, shh, and Radio Susie looked at me and says, who are you telling to shut up? I said, no, it's the name of the book.
Oh, that's funny.
Now, let me ask you this. What was it that caused you to write this book? What was it that you wanted people to know?
Well, this was my third attempt at writing the book. And what I really felt like, before, when I tried writing it, I felt like it was too early and I wasn't ready to express myself. And then this third time, I set up a publisher because I really wanted to get it done and set a goal for myself. And the whole point of it was to help myself. And I felt like if I had someone be so honest to me about the whole situation, that it would have helped me out a bit more throughout my struggles.
Now, by the way, with the bulimia, the depression, cutting, you know, that's, there's so many kids that do that today. The bulimia and the depression, what started that? Are you aware of, when it started, but what caused it? What brought it on?
I know the depression started as a child, and I didn't notice it until I hit my high school years. So in grade 9, the depression brought on the bulimia and the cutting as a way of coping with what I was feeling.
Now, by the way, when we talk about coping and depression, most people don't know how to cope with depression. When it comes on, you have no idea what started it, and it affects, obviously, so many phases and parts of your life. What was it like? What was it like in school with that? What was it like with your friends? What was going on?
My mind was always working because I was always reminding myself to just be strong and be happy, in front of everyone else because I didn't want to drag anyone else down because I knew what it felt being down. So I didn't want to put anyone in that situation, and I didn't want anyone treating me any differently. So I wanted to hide it and just keep it from them.
Now, by the way, in cutting, you know, and then I know there's so many kids that do that. What brings that on? Is that a pain that's worse than the pain that you're going through? Is that a way to move away from the depression?
For me, the cutting was a release. It's when everything felt so built up, it felt when I cut, it's like it let all the pressure out and I could breathe again and think properly again.
Okay. Now, by the way, how long did it take for that to stop? What was the correlating factor that caused that to diminish and go away eventually?
It took at least 7 years.
Yeah.
But it was, You had to fight off the urges. You had to find something else to do. For me to stop the cutting, I had to leave my house because that's where I could cut. So I just leave the house until the feeling went away.
Now, by the way, when you anybody in a similar situation like that, when you get into that kind of a let's call it a pattern, because it is a pattern. What about people trying to help you? I noticed that you refuse help. You push people away. What causes that? Was there any way that you were calling out for help, or were they not recognizing it?
No, I truly feel that you can't get help from anyone else until you actually want to help yourself. Because no matter, my family, we're really close, and they wanted to help me and tried to help me as much as they could. But I wasn't ready to get help, and I wasn't ready to give up the cutting or the bulimia.
Okay, now, by the way, with the bulimia, obviously you were getting very, very, very thin. Was there any other health problems attached to it?
I'd get a few ulcers in my stomach, my mouth, my teeth were very sensitive, factors like that. It wasn't anything too crazy.
No, and I hear you very loud and clear. What about medication? You know, when depression in and of itself is something that most people have no idea what it is. Even some of the professionals have a hard time getting a handle on it for most people. So what do? You're depressed. You can't move through it. You medicate. Now, what about medication and depression?
At first, I was willing to take it to try. I was very against it throughout the years. I was on and off it quite a few times. I flushed the medication a few times. I thought if I wanted to be happy, I didn't need to take a pill to make me happy. That's the way I was looking at it. But as I am now, I'm on the medication, and I find with the medication, it helps, but just taking a pill isn't going to make it go away. There's so much more to it. You still have to open up, you have to talk to somebody, and you have to actually figure out what the problem is.
Now, I know that now that you're working with parents, obviously, to recognize some of the symptoms. Is it that well hidden? Do parents really go about their daily lives and not notice there's a problem until it's too late?
I believe so. I believe if the person really wants to hide it, they'll get so used to hiding it, it'll become very easy for them. Over the years, it became very easy for me to hide. Even when it came out to my family that I was bulimic and cutting, I could still do it without them noticing. So it's kind of like if there's a will, there's a way. You'll find a way to do it if you really want to without someone knowing it.
But what about school? And then when I say what about school, did you hide your depression in school? Did they know that you were depressed?
No, they didn't.
Ah, okay. Now, I'm going to play a role here. I'm a parent, and I have a child that's 14, 15, 16 years old, younger, maybe a little older. What am I going to look for? What will I see in that child that's going to trigger something in me to say, I better take a second look?
I'd probably watch for emotions more, or just being by yourself a lot, because I know. I didn't want to interact very much, as little as I could, because it's hard pretending all day long. So I'd probably keep an eye on how much alone time they spend together. Maybe, depending on the cutting, we can hide it as much as we can, but you can always start to notice. Even with bulimia, you can start to notice, because I know my brother-in-law noticed in my eyes a lot. They'd be bloodshot or something, and he was the first one to recognize something.
Oh, now, okay, now, when he recognized something, what did he say? Who did he say it to? How did they bring? How did your family bring it out into the open?
They didn't bring it out into the open right away. He let my sister know, and that's before I brought it out. So he had let my sister know kind of what he was thinking, and then later on when I brought it out, she saw that he was right.
Okay, now, what caused you to finally bring it out?
An accident.
Isn't that the way it always happens?
I was talking to one of my brother's friends that was going through what I was going through, and she became concerned for me and ended up telling him, and it was just the process. He told my sister, and then she confronted me, and we went on from there.
All right. Now, when she confronted you, was that easy for you to handle?
No, I was rather upset. Yeah. I wasn't ready to open up yet. I didn't want everybody to know yet. So it was kind of difficult going through, because then we had to tell my mom, and it was the whole basis on me for trying to explain myself to everybody and why I was doing it.
Oh, sure. Now, by the way, how'd your mom deal with it? You know, your sister's going to be one thing, but now all of a sudden your mom that's a whole different story. How'd your mom handle it?
My parents were in denial for a long time. They didn't want to believe it because from what they saw, everything was fine. So it took them a while, but slowly they opened up more, and she started to try and learn more about it. She'd go on the internet, and like I said, I was difficult, so I didn't open up very much for her. So she was really trying to find out as much information as she could to try and help me as it went on. And lots of the times when she'd ask me if I'm okay, is everything going good, I could say yes, and she'd believe me, and I could just keep going. Because in a way, when I said yes, she just wanted it all to be over for me.
Was there any time that your parents thought that maybe it was their fault? Did you run into that at all?
I don't.
No, go ahead. Because there's usually a lot of guilt, and then they'll bring it back on themselves. You know, what could I have done different, etc. So did you run into that at all?
I think earlier on they ran into it, but at this point they know they did what they could. Because I know I had an overdose, and I know my dad thought it was his fault. So they have had a little bit, they've had guilt throughout, but at this point they understand that they did what they could do to help me with what I gave them.
Yeah, no, I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Tiffany, do you have a website we can find you at by the book?
Yes, it's TiffanyLCarls.com.
Okay, one more time.
TiffanyLCarls.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing, you may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you're got your way. Say. if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I'd do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you now, some of these days,
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Michael Scott with us, a professor in the Department of Geography and Geosciences at Salisbury University. He's also the graduate director of the Master of Science in GIS Management Program, as well as the director of the Eastern Shore Regional GIS Cooperative. He has a PhD in geography from the University of South Carolina, specializing in environmental hazards and GIS. He's also had over 15 years of experience applying GIS and modeling to solve environmental hazards problems. And Michael, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Michael Ray.
I bet you've been popular in the last week or so.
Yeah, it's been a little busy, to be honest.
I imagine that. What do you think, Mike? What do you think caused this?
Oh, well, that's a good question. We're probably going to be working on trying to figure that out for some time. Our best guess, because it's not always as clear for East Coast earthquakes as it is for West Coast.
Sure.
For East Coast earthquakes, we think the most likely cause is both leftover energy in the crust from when the Appalachian Mountains formed about 200 million years ago is a big cause. And then the other one is what we call isostatic rebound. And basically the simple answer is that about 15,000 years ago, we had the end of the Little Ice Age. And, of course, across the top of our continent, across Canada, New York, Maine, Vermont, all of those areas were covered in glaciers. That put a lot of weight on the continent at the north end and actually basically tilted it to the north. And ever since those glaciers melted, the continent has been slowly, slowly tipping back down to the south. And so that also causes rocks to move, and when those rocks to move, all of a sudden we get an earthquake.
Now, I was brought up in Los Angeles, and my goodness, you know, I was weaned on earthquakes. I was in the, it was a big one in 1952 and any of the earthquakes that followed, and I left in 83, and I ended up in the interior of Alaska, and somewhere in the 90s, I was sitting in the gym one morning, and we could hear the rattle of all those weight plates, and they got louder and louder, and we realized we're in the middle of an earthquake. So, but it was a completely different kind of an earthquake than it was in the Los Angeles area. Now, isn't there a fault line in New York also, somewhere in that vicinity, that they're waiting someday that that thing's going to hit?
Yeah, there are a number of what we call relic faults. So faults not active, there's not a lot, in fact, none really active faulting going on in the eastern part of the United States. All those faults, and there are plenty that are there, but most of them are older. They're from an earlier time period when the Appalachian Mountains were forming. And so they've got their eye on a couple of them. And this one in Virginia that took place last week, that's an area where we know has had seismic activity before. But usually when they have them, again, a lot of times it's not necessarily, particularly with this one, you couldn't put your finger on and go, oh, that's the fault line that came from. For example, your experience in Los Angeles and both Los Angeles and Alaska, setting the volcano created earthquakes aside in Alaska, but the fault created earthquakes, it's very clear that, you know, okay, there's the fault, and we can expect that we can actually measure the stress and try to figure out exactly how much stress those faults are under. And in the East Coast, it's much more hidden.
Well, sure, and it's a different kind of a quake. The one in the Los Angeles area of Southern California, actually, when that hit, it was very shaky, very rigid ground. The one in Alaska, it would sway. It was completely, it's a completely different kind of a quake. And if somebody has not been in an earthquake and it's their very first experience, Michael, it's scary. And when I say it's scary, because you can't run away from it. There's nothing to do. You just have to wait it out.
Absolutely. No, nowhere to go. That's right.
No, none at all.
Yeah, in fact, we actually saw that, and people watching the news with the earthquake last week, you can see that sort of panic in people as they run outside, for example, from the building that they're in as it's swaying or moving. And of course, what we try to try to tell people is that is exactly what you don't want to do, because that's a lot of our injuries and deaths from earthquakes come from where people ran outside, and then stuff from the upper floors of buildings, unreinforced masonry or plate glass or whatever it happens to be, falls down on them and hurts them. So, and it's just that comes from the fact that we're not in the East Coast in particular. You know, we have anywhere between 40 and 50 earthquakes any given year here in the Mid-Atlantic alone. But most of them are so small that you can't feel them at all. Or if you do feel them, it's very slight and it's very localized. To get a large-ish quake like the one we got last week, that's felt by a lot of people, and actually you can see things swaying in the lab where we are. We're on the Delmarva Peninsula, about halfway between the Atlantic Ocean and Chesapeake Bay. In our building alone, you can see monitors swaying on top of desks and ceiling tiles moving back and forth. That is strange enough that many people just weren't quite sure what to do.
I was taught years and years and years ago that if there is an earthquake, get into a door jamb, get into a door, into a doorway, because it's pretty well reinforced, and that's about the least likely thing that's going to go in a building when there is an earthquake.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I tell you, you growing up on the West Coast have that drilled into you from the time you're born, pretty much. And
sure,
here on the East Coast, unfortunately, you know, I think we do a fairly decent job on things like hurricanes and floods and other sorts of hazards to prepare for. But given the fact that there have been several significant earthquakes, a couple even catastrophic, that have happened east of the Mississippi, we're probably remiss in not talking enough about that simple rule about what to do if you start to feel the ground shake.
Now, by the way, what about the Midwest? I'm in the Midwest now. I've been here for about 5 years. And knock on wood, there's not supposed to be any earthquakes here. But isn't there a fault line that runs through the Midwest?
Right. Well, it's not a fault, although perhaps it's worse. It's called a mid-plate a seismic zone. We actually, the best guess of scientists is that it's a weak spot in the crust. Mm. It's called the New Madrid Earthquake Zone, and it is just at where, right along the Mississippi, in southern Missouri and Illinois and Kentucky and where all the states come together there in southern Missouri, is the New Madrid Zone. It actually holds the record for the strongest earthquake in the lower 48 states. We've had stronger ones in Alaska, but the strongest in 1812 was, and of course, this was before we were making comprehensive measurements, so nobody's quite sure. But it was, everybody, describes as catastrophic. It was felt as far away as Washington, D.C. and Boston. The stories are, and there's geologic evidence to back it up, that the quake was so strong it actually reversed the flow of the Mississippi River from headed south to headed north for a period of a couple years until it rerouted itself.
You know, you had mentioned a moment or two ago about handling floods and so on and so forth. This last disaster that we've just hit from the East Coast, you know, with the floods and the hurricanes and the rest of it.
What causes, still going on. That's right.
Yeah. What causes something to be that strong? I mean, that was a shock to everybody. It was one, I'm sure, the most powerful event like that that's ever happened on the East Coast. My niece is, they drove 17 hours to get here because they evacuated their homes. I mean, you know, millions of people, et cetera. What causes mm-hmm. something like that to be that strong?
Yeah, that's a good question. Another one where this particular hurricane, it's interesting from the science perspective about how we had the track predicted particularly well, and we had the amount of wind predicted reasonably well, but what we did not particularly account for very well is that the way the hurricane would behave once it came on shore, and what it ended up doing is throwing a tremendous amount of energy in the form of wind out over the ocean in the eastern part of the hurricane. And it threw a tremendous amount of energy in from a rain and precipitation perspective on the western side. So it ended up creating even more rain than anybody was really prepared for, quite honestly. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish your statement.
No, I was just saying we're going to be trying to figure out exactly why that was. I mean, obviously, we, you know, most people know that we get the hurricane gets its strength from the warm waters. It creates a convective effect that once it gets started is very difficult to stop. And so as it gets started, it builds and builds. And again, what was just really curious about this one is how it affected and how it threw. And it mainly it might simply be, it not only when it rode up into New England, I think that what we didn't really take a lot of, didn't take a hard look at was what the impact would be as those hurricane clouds dumping rain already got lifted up into the Green Mountains and up into the Adirondacks of upstate New York. As it got lifted up into the mountains, it was forced to rise and therefore precipitated even more rain. And that, of course, is where now we see most of the deaths coming from and where people really were not aware enough of what the threat was. People in that area have seen flooding before. They understand how to deal with that. And the emergency management folks there and the citizens were caught a bit off guard.
I remember when 100 years ago when I was in grammar school, I was actually was in the, almost but no, in the 50s when I was in grammar school. I remember we used to have bomb drills. You know, the teacher would all of a sudden say a word and everybody would get under their desk. What do you do for hurricanes? What do you do for earthquakes? Is there anything that the schools are doing today to teach the kids what to do in case of, you know, that first thing that you do when the situation occurs? And I don't even think families are prepared for an earthquake today or anything that happened, let's say, on the East Coast. There's just little, when I say little information, you're there. You got your fingers on the pulse of what's going on. Average person doesn't have that, and I don't hear anybody teaching it anymore what to do preventative if something, some kind of a catastrophe like this happens.
I think you're probably right about that. It's my understanding. Now, I haven't lived out on the West Coast, but I have friends of mine that do, and they still run earthquake drills in the public school system, say in California. That's sort of standard operating procedure for them. For the East Coast, it's just not the case. The main thing they drill for is fire. And I suppose from their perspective, from the school's perspective, it's a matter of what threat is like. And they do, of course, terrorist drills. They do that too. Lockdown, you know, Columbine type scenario. They do those sorts of drills as well. Now, I guess from the school's perspective, those are the threats that are most likely to affect the students while they're in school. Whereas hurricanes, of course, we have enough lead time so that people, if they were, you know, called to evacuate, they can actually evacuate theoretically. But I think you're right. We're probably not doing a good enough job. We've been advocating for some time to try to get local governments in particular to go ahead and lay out, say, for example, very specific evacuation zones. They do this very well in Florida, by the way. Florida has a tremendous hurricane education program for their citizens and their school children all the way up through senior citizens. And some other southern states are a little bit better at this than others, but still, the creation of evacuation maps that then get published in the newspaper every year at the start of hurricane season or a little bit before, so that when the time comes to move people, you can simply go, okay, all of you in Zone B or all of you in Zone C, you got to go. Having that kind of specificity of knowing exactly what zone you're in, and when you get called, you know that they're calling for you to go, because there's a lot of questions on the evacuation. This was true in New York. A lot of people who were along the edges weren't even sure they were in the zone or not, that sort of thing. And so I think we could be doing a lot better about that. And then finally, I think the part that is getting out fairly well is what to do if you're sheltering in place. So, you know, how to keep your refrigerator cold if your power is out, or, you know, having candles and, you know, having a disaster kit with a first aid kit and medicines and that sort of thing. That message, I think, is fairly well out there. But, you know, other than that, I think you could be right.
You know, by the way, when you mentioned disaster kit, I spent 23 years in the interior, so it was survival. I mean, obviously, you get, you know, 2 feet out of town, there's things out there that would eat you. But the point of contention was that it was survival. At 40 below, you don't get in your car and drive down the street without something to protect you just in case you had a blowout or your car died. And I think that's the same thing with the kind of disasters that we have now. If you take somebody from the East Coast now, they'll know, or somebody from the West Coast that's been exposed to these things, you know, a few times, time and again. Florida is always getting exposed or hit by these things. But if you get into the Midwest and you get into a lot of the states that have never been exposed to it, you don't think about it until it happens. And I think there's where the problem is to get people to start thinking about it. And I don't mean going overboard with it, but just realistically taking a look at, have certain things in the house just in case the power goes out. Look at the millions of people that were left without power through this last disaster that we just had, or are still going through on the East Coast.
Still are. That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. What do you do?
No, I think that's true.
And we don't. And we're not prepared for it, and we should be prepared for it. Now, what about pre-warning? How close are we to know when somebody's going to hit something so we can get out before it happens? Earthquakes, is that something that you just don't know until it happens, or is there
There is good news there. The good news on the earthquake front is in certain parts of the country, specifically in Southern California, they have been working very hard and have been, it works now, but they're perfecting an earthquake warning system that gives people anywhere between 20 and 30 seconds to let them know that an earthquake is coming. Now, 20 and 30 seconds to somebody who hasn't been in an earthquake, it doesn't sound like a lot of time, but as you just mentioned, you know, getting to a doorway or getting into an interior bathroom that has lots of pipes and whatnot all around it, these are the places that we know from research tend to survive best during a major quake. 20 seconds could literally be the difference between you gathering your children into the right room or not. And so, the way they accomplish that is any given earthquake sends out different types of waves. And without getting too technical about it, there are very short waves that move very quickly out after an earthquake happens. And then there are longer, slower waves that come along afterwards. Now, we're talking about in terms of seconds, they're coming along afterwards. But the short waves, we call them P waves, that come out in the beginning are usually not terribly dangerous. They shake things, but they're not the kind of rolling wave that you expect to see a lot of damage with. And so that difference in time between the first set of waves and the second set of waves is how they are attempting to alert people of the earthquake. Now, having said that, the trouble is, obviously, that works fairly well for Southern California. When you know what kind of quake you're generally going to get and you know generally where it's going to come from and that sort of thing, you know, on the East Coast, we just don't have anything like that.
No, and then I got it loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Michael, is there a website we can find you at and get more information?
Our website for our organization is www.esrgc.org. But I really encourage people, if they're interested in this sort of thing, there's a tremendous amount of information up at the university, the USGS, the United States Geological Survey, that's usgs.gov. Tremendous information, not only where earthquakes are happening, but how to prepare for them.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, bye-bye. And a lover's burning light will warm them in a night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Patricia Bragg with us, MD, PhD, Dr. Bragg. She's a dynamic speaker and a living, energetic symbol of the healthy lifestyle that she teaches. Her father, Paul Bragg, opened America's first health food store in 1912 and is known as the father of America's health movement by introducing the benefits of purified water, juices, herbal teas, and organic foods to the U.S. market. Dr. Paul C. Bragg was a pioneer in the health movement in America, and now Patricia takes that place. The Bragg Live Food Products Company is nearing its 100th anniversary in 2012. Hey, Patricia Bragg, welcome back.
Aloha.
Aloha to you,
here
too.
I am, by the way, here I am in Hawaii, Michael.
Are you having a good time?
I'm having a wonderful time. I'm in my bathing suit right now at the beach at Diamond Head.
Oh, wonderful. I wish I was there, too. You know what? That's probably got the greatest weather. Right now, for some reason, it's summer, and it went down to 68 degrees here. I'm in the Midwest. I'm in the Milwaukee area now. But it's better than being on the East Coast right now.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Our news and paper has been filled with a terrible hurricane, floods, and all.
Yeah. No, I hear you loud and clear. Let me ask you this. The world of food that you're so versed in, you've lived it, you've experienced it, and we talk about anti-aging and all of these things. The kind of foods that obviously people eat are the worst things that can happen to them. What is it that we need to introduce to diets that will allow our immune system to work biologically, allow us to fight aging and all of those diseases that affect us when we are not in good health?
Well, I tell you what, the simplest it. C. Everett Koop, the retired Surgeon General, said that my father, Paul Bragg, did more for the health of Americans than any one person he knew of. My father told people the importance that this is the Bragg healthy lifestyle. You are what you eat and drink. What you eat and drink is body fuel that keeps you going. It'll either keep you ageless or break your health down. So remember, you are what you eat, what you drink, and next is what you breathe. And that's why we do not want anybody to be around secondhand smoke or smoke, because your lungs are vital, vital. And no secondhand smoke. Don't get out of smoky restaurants. Or they're banned smoking in a lot of places, but a lot of places they haven't. And
well,
so
no
you
other
are
questions.
What you eat, drink, breathe. And next is what you think. Garbage in, garbage out. You're born with a beautiful miracle computer, your brain. It's amazing. You can remember when you were 5 years old or even younger. You can remember all the different things that happened in your life. It's amazing. It's a miracle computer. Garbage in, garbage out. Remember, your thoughts are living. They're living. And if you put a lot of garbage thoughts in, it can bring stress, disease, illness, and unhappiness. And before you speak, put it to the test. Is it good? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Now, my friend's husband just lost his job because he had an argument with his boss and in front of the whole staff. And you know what? He humiliated his boss, and 5 minutes later he was fired.
Yeah.
And so remember, you can't take some words back. So before you speak, is it good? Is it kind? Is it necessary? And the last, Michael, is what you do. Here I am in my bathing suit, been exercising. I'm doing stationary jogging, as I told you the last time I was with you. Oh, I never sit down. I keep moving. And my 70 trillion cells get a free massage. Now, circulation is one of the keys to good health. Those of you that sit around a lot, get up when you're watching the telly and do take your shoes off, do some stationary jogging and bare feet. We were nutritionist Dr. Schultz, the famous foot doctor. We kept him going to almost 100. What do you think of that? And women are killing their feet with these terrible shoes they're wearing. They're like they're walking around on their tiptoes. They're throwing their pelvic off, their female organs, their backs get out of whack, and their feet are hurting. By the way, we have a wonderful foot book, the Bragg Wonderful Healthy Foot Book. And anybody has foot troubles, Michael, they should read it.
Now, by the way, Patricia, what about people with varicose veins? You know, I mean, this is something that's
running. Oh, my gosh, listen, varicose veins, they bring it upon themselves. One of the worst habits men and women have is sitting with their legs crossed. You're not meant to sit like a pretzel. Your heart is your major pump. Oh, it's pumping every second of your life. It's pumping your blood, your river of life throughout your body. Feel your noses right now. Feel your ears. If they're cold, that means your heart is struggling to get the circulation to your nose, your ears. How are your hands? Now, last, your feet. Well, when you sit with your legs crossed, you're putting a burden on the major artery and back of your knee. Oh, if you sit long enough, your foot will go to sleep because the heart will say, oh, what the heck with it, close it off. And so you know what? It doesn't pump the blood down there. And so you get up, this very famous orthopedic surgeon, he said, Patricia, I get more business from people watching the telly at night, and they get up to go to bed, and their foot has gone to sleep, and their whole leg, and they fall and break a hip or a leg, and they end up with me in the hospital.
And now, so by the way, remember, Patricia, is there anything that
veins,
we can take if you already have it?
Back trouble, on and on. So what you do if you have varicose veins, can I go on, Michael?
Absolutely. I was going to ask that question. Yes.
Okay, what you can do if you have varicose veins, I'm going to tell you what you need to do. Varicose veins are pooled blood. In other words, it's all of a sudden found a little, like little caves and pockets, and what they do, they pool. So what you need to do is get the blood out of those little pockets. You put your feet up in the air against the wall, or up on your couch while you're watching the telly. Take your palm of your hand and go over one leg at a time like a little iron. Just press gently over the varicose veins and get them back up into your groin. Get the blood going. Get it out of the little pocket areas. And sometimes in 2 to 3 weeks, you will see the varicose veins disappear. And
wow.
Now vitamin C is known as the cement vitamin. I would have everybody up that has varicose veins and or fragile capillaries. Some people come to me and they said, "Oh, Patricia, I just bump myself and I get bruised." I said, fragile capillaries. You need more vitamin C. Vitamin C is known as the cement vitamin. Not only does it build up your immune system, Linus Pauling, the one that put did a lot of the vitamin C research, was our very dear friend. Oh, he said, "I do miracles with vitamin C." He saved people from having their legs amputated that had gangrene. You give them a slow drip of vitamin C, like 50 grams of vitamin C, which is huge, and an IV, a 3 to 4 hour slow drip in the hospital. Or if not, an RN can come and do it at home if the doctor will order it. They can go on and see what miracles. Linus Pauling saved thousands of people, Michael, from having their legs amputated, especially diabetics.
Now, I remember years ago, I had cancer, 14 years ago. And the first thing that they did with me is they gave me a vitamin C, what is it when they run it right into your blood?
It's an IV.
Yeah, intravenous. Yeah, they just, first thing out of the box, they gave me intravenous vitamin C.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and
that's
it works.
Wonderful. Well, listen, I've seen miracles happen. We saved the life of Conrad Hilton, the hotel man, and that they said he had 5 days to live when he was 80, and his daughter-in-law, Trish Hilton, called us. We were at the hospital in 20 minutes in Beverly Hills. Put him on an IV of called Total Care. It's vitamin, minerals, nutrients, and trace minerals instead of sugar water, what they usually give. And then we gave him a tube to his nose, the wonderful oxygen, the invisible staff of life right away. It was so weak he could hardly breathe. And then we gave him physiotherapy 3 times a day, hands-on massage. And guess where we had him in 4 days? Out of the hospital. And he went, he remarried. What do you think that got married again? Went dancing 3 nights a week. He said, "I'm living on the Bragg Healthy Lifestyle." And this teach, Michael. We teach the Bragg Healthy Lifestyle. We have Cloris Leachman, who is now in her 80s. She was on Dancing with the Stars. She's been following us for over 40 years. She followed our book, Miracle of Fasting, and got rid of her, guess what, her asthma. She said, "Patricia, I had asthma so bad I could hardly talk, let alone sing." And now she's in her 80s and going strong.
Well, let's talk about one thing. I want to make sure we have time for this. The apple cider vinegar. That stuff is so good.
Oh, my
what is the difference?
Golly, that is a miracle. The book is called The Apple Cider Vinegar Miracle Health System. They can go to Bragg.com and see all the testimonies we have on the Bragg apple cider vinegar. People that get rid of their arthritis, their neuritis. They get rid of their constant sore throats. People that have had trouble with athlete's foot for years, you soak your pinkies in the apple cider vinegar bath at night while you're watching the telly. 2 tablespoons of the apple vinegar in a little pan of water. And boy, in no time you get rid of. If you have nail fungus, if you have bites of any kind, mosquito bites, all kinds, you get rid of it. It kills the venom, and you put it on the bites right away. If you get a sunburn, that I have 3 drinks a day and keeps me young, 2 to 3 teaspoons and 8 ounces of purified water, and I love honey or 100% maple syrup or stevia herbia. The herb stevia is wonderful, by the way, for people that are diabetic. And I'm not diabetic, but I have a lot of friends that unfortunately are. Okay, listen to this. They can have that drink 3 times a day. And Katy Perry, I've been her nutritionist since she was 8 years old. When she was 12, I bought her first guitar, and she just got a lot of awards for singing. And she has our vinegar drink. She travels with it. She has it 3 times a day. She said, "Patricia, I love your Bragg vinegar drink. Oh, it keeps my voice so strong." She's been on all the shows, and I used to call her God Songbird because her parents were my ministers. What do you think of that?
Oh, I think it's great. Now, we've got a couple of minutes to go, but I want to make sure we talk about one other thing. Patricia, I've listened and listened and I've listened to so many people. One of the biggest problems people have today is breathing and circulation. So what do we do about circulation and breathing?
Oh, my golly. We have a book on superpower breathing book. It is wonderful for high energy. We have Bob Anderson, Anderson.com, the stretching coach. He said, Patricia, I give the superpower breathing exercise to all my athletes and they become champions. Breathe deep. I have a lot of the Met singers. I have the Beach Boys, Madonna, and I teach them to breathe deeply. It's so important. Good posture. Never sit with your legs crossed. Remember, you are what you eat, drink, breathe, think, say, and do. And I fast every Monday. I'm fasting, our book, Miracle of Fasting. Listen, you know, Michael, your health is your wealth. And just remember, before you put the food in your mouth, what is it going to do for you? Open your mouth. That's your fuel tank. And so what you eat and drink today walks and talks tomorrow. Simple as that. We kept Jack LaLanne going to almost 97, and he was a puny, sickly boy, been out of school. He said, Patricia, I hadn't heard your dad that one night, I would have been dead at 17. What do you think of that? So breathing is important. Purified water, no fluoride. It's a killer. And so I live simple. Just remember, you are what you eat, drink, breathe, think, say, and do with your 640 muscles. Get out and walk. If it's snowing or raining or wherever you are, just get out and swing your arms, walk around your living room, and do some stationary jogging. You're going to be surprised. I don't care what position you are. We took Conrad Hill at 80 dying in the hospital. He said 5 days to live, and guess what? He had a long life after that.
And by the way, I think it's absolutely wonderful because when it comes down to it, no matter what, it's your health starts and ends with what you eat, because what you eat turns into a chemical, and that chemical is going to go to the certain part of your body that's going to cause it to be well, or if there's the deficiency, it's not going to be well. So, Patricia, you're spot on. It has to do with what you eat, and more importantly, the degree of cleanliness of that food.
Oh, of course, of course. And, you know, I live a very simple life, a very simple life. I earn my food by exercise, good posture. I've never sat with my legs crossed. I'm 5 feet tall. And you know what? I stand tall, walk tall, and I am tall. And they can go to my website, bragg.com, or youtube.com, Patricia Bragg, and they can hear me lecture. And I travel the world, over 30 trips around the world. I love it, live it, and preach it, the Bragg Healthy Lifestyle.
Oh, Patricia, we're out of time. What website we can find you at?
Bragg.com, Bragg.com. And here I am in Hawaii. You can go to Bragg Exercise, BraggHawaiiExercise.com also, and see me. The class is 6 days a week. I'm there every morning except Sunday at 9 o'clock when I'm here.
Wonderful. Hey, Patricia, thank you. And you know what? I'm going to send you a picture of me taken last year, just to get your feedback from it.
Really?
And by the way, have fun in Hawaii, stay out of trouble, and don't pick up any hitchhikers.
No. Blessings to the world, and may the world be filled with peace and health.
Okay, thank you, and good night.
Thank you. With love to all of you. Aloha.
Say it's me that you adore, but now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore.
That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Kathleen Puckett back with us. Dr. Kathleen Puckett. She is a former FBI psychological profiler in the counterterrorism unit. She is the co-author of Homeland in Security. Hey, Kathy, welcome back.
Hi, Michael. Nice to talk to you.
I want to start this entire thing out with one word, okay? This is a good one now. Ready for this? Accidentally.
Yeah, things happen that way.
Oh my God,
Michael!
How do they do that, Kathy? How do they accidentally release thousands of dangerous U.S. State Department cables? How did they do that?
You know, it's really amazing. This is why I will never be a libertarian because unfortunately, even though there are things that I admire about. You know, certain aspects of libertarianism, there are aspects of government that need to be handled really carefully. And among them, very specifically, is information about our agents, our United States, our American agents, doing work overseas. The American public is unaware a lot of times of what CIA and other intelligence agencies and under other groups professional groups, not political appointed groups, but professional people whose job it is to, you know, there are a lot of countries around the world who engage in the world's second oldest profession, which is espionage. We know what the first one is. But that means, unfortunately, that we can't keep our hands clean. We have to go in there and do that, too. And you can't really do that well if your name and information about what you're doing is accidentally released by WikiLeaks.
Now, by the way, there's something to take a look at also. Look at David, who is the talk show host recently. I'll never forget what's his name. I never watch him. There goes age. Who was it that just got threatened by Islamic extremists to cut his... Letterman. Yes. Now, okay, so he makes a joke and they threaten to kill him. And if you're, you know, and if you're a good follower of the religion, you're going to find him and you're going to cut his tongue out. All right. That's something that happened on television. But what about all of these things being leaked into the wrong hands and the jihads and the assassinations that can take place with the names? You put these people at risk. Why are they going to go out and do it in the first place if they know their families may suffer the consequence? In addition to that, what gives them the strength to be able to go on with their jobs when everybody in the world knows who they are, why they are, and what they're doing?
Exactly. You know, the really sad thing about this is this WikiLeaks, what I thought was really preposterous about this story about WikiLeaks accidentally releasing the names of all these people who, as you say, are now targets as a result, very, very critically targets of extremism and everything else. The sad thing about this is the really absurd thing that WikiLeaks problem with this is that, gee, you know, they didn't really intend to do this, but mixed messages happened when, you know, one WikiLeaks person talked to another, and they sent material to Julian Assange, which he mistakenly, you know, any head of government would be pilloried for this, but Julian Assange just said, well, it was just a mistake. I just assumed that everything in there was releasable, so I released it. I mean, that's the level of protection that these people have in, you know, to give important information. They obviously didn't think that the information was important enough and didn't realize what the implications were. And even worse than that, Michael, they may have, and they didn't care.
Now, by the way, Kathy, this is what you call a lie. I accidentally thought, so I just released it because the guy's not stupid. And there's where the problem is. If he was, okay, I'd buy it, but he's not. He's smart.
No.
The problem we have is, quote unquote, there's no consequence. Anybody can say anything they want to say, do what they want to do, and it doesn't matter what it is that they say because there's nothing we're going to do about it.
Well, the bad thing about the Assange thing and WikiLeaks is that that whole thing that happened, everything that was released in that huge, you know, regurgitation of millions of documents is already out there. I mean, once, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, there's nothing that can be done to repair the damage that has been done by some of those WikiLeaks revelations. And not that they were all, they're not all the same. Information isn't always all the same. It isn't all bad. It isn't all good. It information that's released doesn't have, to be categorized as either good or bad. It just depends on what happens as a result. It's the context and the consequence of the release of the information that's proving the problem. As far as it not having any kind of consequences, Assange is under, he has a lot of supporters, but he's under all kinds of pressure too. I mean, he has been indicted, and you know, as far as whether he will stand, you know, in some sort of trial remains to be seen. So, but it's going to be interesting I don't know how anyone could say that this is the fallacy that exists all the time with the media, generally, in saying it's the people's right to know, therefore we have the right to know anything, even if it hurts someone.
Wait, that's the not so. I believe in transparency. I do, Kathy. I believe it. But there's a
point
where
it
stops. Yeah, I know. I know. When I say I know, I don't take that for granted. I know that how you feel about this. I mean, we've talked so many times over such a long period of time. But there's a point where there should be a wall, a block. There are things that you just can't know because it's too dangerous. It has nothing to do with your economy. It has to do with whether you're going to get killed or not.
Exactly. It isn't a matter of whether you make more or less money. It isn't a matter of, you know, whether you get the promotion or not. It's a matter of whether somebody's mother or father or son or daughter gets killed.
Absolutely. And I don't think that they really get that. And I'm very concerned about the way that communication is dealt with and used today. You know, let's face it, they're talking all over the place about radio stations, internet, everybody, you know, speech being controlled. If you say something, you're off, you'll get blocked, you'll get shut down. As long as it goes a certain way, you're okay. That's not what we're about. And if you take that very same free speech that we're supposed to have, free speech is fine unless you're going to hurt someone. It's that old, you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded building. You're going to hurt somebody.
Right.
Yes. So then it's all of a sudden when somebody is at risk, it's not free speech anymore.
Exactly, Michael. That's exactly right. It's the common sense. The whole thing is that freedom for the sake of, you know, just because something can be done doesn't always mean that it should be done. And you know, I mean, I've always felt this way about technology. I've always felt this way about advances, you know, and science. You know, a pure scientist will say nothing should impede science and science should progress. And I believe, you know, Robert Oppenheimer had some real thoughts about that after his work culminated in the Manhattan Project, culminated in the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. By the only atomic bombs that have been used in war. Lots of pros and cons on that, but his whole point was, in his team of scientists, they were not ostensibly doing something to wage war against an opponent, which is what it was used for. They were going after the pure science of it. They wanted to know. They wanted to advance knowledge.
No, by the way,
not always the right thing to do.
Yeah, when you talk about science, Kathy, if you define science literally, science is something that's provable. That's all science is. So, you know, and we can twist it any way and shape and form that we want. Yes,
right.
we created the bombs, and they've gotten even more sophisticated, and our weaponry has gotten more sophisticated. But if you go back to the Civil War, if you go back to, better yet, go back to Custer's Last Stand. And I mean, when those people went to war, they went to war. I mean, that was hand-to-hand combat. They were they weren't the amount of people that were killed as opposed to what one bomb can do, etc. But that was some vicious stuff that went on, both sides. So war is nasty any way you look at it. We've just gotten more sophisticated in the way that we deal with it.
I know. And, you know, you read accounts of pilots who piloted bombers who said that there was such an eerie calm, you know, at, you know, 35,000 feet as they let the bombs go down. And, you know, and to them, they're so dissociated from what they're actually doing. You know, that's sort of what happened with WikiLeaks. It's kind of like, for them, it's the principle of there should be full transparency and nothing should ever be secret is their thought, without thinking about the real-world consequences that happen to people as a result of that kind of thought.
Okay, but what if I did an interview with Assange and I said, okay, how much money do you have in the bank? How many times do you go to bed with your wife? Are you able to climax? Do you have ED? I know I'm being risque, but at the same time, those are things that's his business. It is not for anybody else to know.
Right. Well, you know,
didn't he say everybody should know everything about everything?
Yes, absolutely. And however, he's very close-mouthed about his own life.
Absolutely. That's the whole point. The whole point, if you're going to open up, you open up about everything. But
right.
The people who want you to open up don't. Did he not get a Nobel Peace Prize?
No, he was talked about it. His name was talked about as getting a Nobel Peace Prize. No. He wasn't a recipient. No.
All right, but he was up for it, wasn't he?
Well, people were talking. I mean, there was talk about that, but I don't know how serious it was.
Right.
You know, he's broken a lot of laws.
No, absolutely. And again, go after him. You know, there's got to be consequence. If there was one death or one people hurt from this information out, he should be hunted down, brought back, and put into jail.
I agree. That's how I, when I saw that article today and sent it to you, Michael, that's exactly what I was thinking. This is a great topic because, full disclosure doesn't mean anything when someone else gets, and you know, attorneys and judges deal with this in the legal system all the time. If you have a witness who's putting themselves in harm's way, standing up in a court and giving evidence against someone for a horrible crime, you have an obligation to make sure, as a part of the legal system, that person doesn't suffer, you know, dire consequences as a result, and that's where things fall apart.
No question about it, absolutely. And I really believe that our legal system today, it's gone way beyond what the legal system was meant to be. And then, Kathy, we go back to that old, you know, are we a system, are we a country ruled by the rule of law or the rule of man? It's becoming
absolutely
the rule of man, and that's not right.
Just exactly what Dick Cheney said, and I know he's come out with his new autobiography, in which he takes absolutely no responsibility for anything he did and makes no bones about the fact that he still thinks that absolutely everything he did was right. No reflection at all. But he was the one who said, we must become a nation of men, not a nation of laws, after 9/11. And that was the beginning of a long, slippery slope that we're still suffering from.
By the way, I totally disagree with him on that. Because you've got to have a medium, some kind of an anchor that you can hang on to, that's going to cause the world to go this way or that way. If it's just quote unquote the rule of man, you get into a you get into a legal debate, and if you're one ideology and there's more people on that side of the ideology, somebody's going to go free or go to jail. And
yeah,
that's not
and that
right.
Is brute force.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. We're getting far away from who and why and what we are. And I think that in and of itself is a shame. And I don't necessarily mean to go back to the 1800s. That's not going to work out. The framers of the Constitution saw some things ahead. They were brilliant in what they did at the time. But obviously, they couldn't forecast the kind of a world that we would be in today and as sophisticated as technology is and so on and so forth. They set it up with the Electoral College, whether that's right or wrong today, because the people in that time, the constituents, most of them couldn't read or write, so they didn't have the wherewithal to be able to vote someone in, so obviously they got the Electoral College. That doesn't apply today.
Right, absolutely. Yes, this, things change, and absolutes, really the kind of absolutism of, you know, everything being all free or everything being completely locked down or brute force is absolute. The absolute view is always going to be wrong because the, you know, even though too much relativism is confusing and a problem in society, you can rationalize almost anything. There can't be, you know, an absolute rule like in this WikiLeaks thing of the, every bit of information should be open and free to the public.
By the way, we're starting to run out of time, but I want to throw this little tidbit out at you to chew on till next week. Do you know who may go up against Obama for the 2012 election?
No, tell me.
Hillary. You know what?
You know,
and if there was a choice between the two of them and that was it, you know I would vote for Hillary, and I would have never said that 2 years ago. Yeah.
I'm gonna remember that.
Okay. Oh, by the way, if that's it, that's the choice. That's where I'm gonna go because I guess we know what the answer to that one is. Anyhow, a website we can find you at.
HomelandInsecurityTheBlog.com.
And you're not supposed to tell anybody that I said I would vote for Hillary Clinton.
No, I'm not going to tell anybody. No.
Okay, that's our secret.
Okay, Michael.
Wonderful. Okay,
nice
I will
talk to,
talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. Okay, bye-bye.
Splish, splash, I was taking a bath. All about Saturday night. Yeah. Rubbed up, just relaxing in the tub. I'm thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, I put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And then a splish, splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, rocking and a rolling. Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. They were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipop with a Peggy Sue. Getting golly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was a rolling and a strolling. Yeah, I was a moving.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, the latest acclaimed book by nationally known speaker and educator Simon Casey. Dr. Simon Casey is Secrets to Emotional Wealth. Follow your yellow brick road. And let us say, Simon, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about emotional wealth, the emotions in and of themselves, people talk about having these good, calm, quality emotions, but that's almost, from what I'm starting to see, and I'm not a clinician, that's something that's learned anymore, Simon. That's not something that just comes automatically, because there's too many variables out there in the world to cause it to go astray.
You're right on. You're absolutely correct. Emotions are to be learned very early in life, and we heavily rely on our parents to teach us what our emotions are right and what emotions are wrong, and how we really talk with them, how we express them, how we communicate them. And we have to learn that very early on. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen. In most cases, we learn to shut the emotions down. We learn to shy away from them.
And is that not just for, Simon, protection, because we feel we need to be protected, from the world, from a different person, from a something? And if we're vulnerable and we show our emotions, somebody's going to know how to get in there and affect us.
Yeah, I mean, there's some need for protection, but primarily the reason we shelter our emotions, we try to protect ourselves, is because we don't think our emotions are okay. We don't believe that what we feel is correct. And for that reason, the more we bottle them up and shy away, the more defensive we become. So they kind of go hand in hand. The less you feel, the more defensive and blocked you become.
There's a term running around, and I know you talk about it, unhealthy addiction. You get some of the people who actually should have the world working for them. You get the Charlie Sheens, the Lindsay Lohans. You know, they're making money. They're in the public eye. Everything that they could ever want is right there. But there's something wrong. You know, every time you turn around, they're going into rehab and coming back out again. What is this something? And that, obviously, those people are exaggerating. But what is that something that we seem to be lacking? What is it what kind of a strength is it that most people just don't have anymore, or are not willing to take the step up and create?
I would like to answer that like this, because there's too many people out there and famous. They tend to be very self-destructive. Reality cannot be comprehended without taking into account feelings. The abstraction of intellect or reasoning are important, but when they lose touch with feelings, they open the way for inhumane and self-destructive acts. What I mean by that is that when people don't feel, they become more self-destructive. So there's a direct correlation between no feelings and acting out. So someone like Charlie Sheen, who is a drug addict on top of that, so addicts usually don't feel. And the reason they don't is because they only learn to feel through their drug of choice. So the more they don't feel, the more self-destructive they become, and they live in this vicious, cyclic world that they can't seem to get out of.
But doesn't it come down to chemistry? And when I say chemistry, obviously the neurosciences are getting very popular today. And there's brain chemistry. You see something that you think is threatening, you know, you get a shot of adrenaline. You see something that you like, you get a shot of dopamine. And, you know, the feel good, that's that addictive kind of from that addictive part of your emotional makeup. And realistically, more and more, if we get people to understand how all of this works, then we wouldn't be so addictive as we are, because if we don't know, we blunder into it, and we are at the effect of it, and the consequences for most people are just horrendous.
Yeah, Michael, you're right on. You look at the effect. Most people are after the effect. You know, a human being could be a drug of choice. A relationship could be a drug of choice. Anything could be a drug of choice. So when you're chasing the effect, and I'm sure you heard some people say, when I met my partner, it was fireworks all over the place, and after about a year or two, there are no more fireworks. They're talking about the addictive effect. Some people are more prone neurologically to that addictive lifestyle, and they also have it in their genes. So unfortunately, there's an element of truth, but you can get around that by understanding yourself, by stopping yourself chasing the quick fixes,
the instant gratifications. And if you stop the instant gratifications, you'll be able to stop the damage, at least minimize the damage to a certain degree.
Well, sure. And also, you know, the when I say protect yourself from people, it's also really, when you come down to it, Simon, it's protecting yourself from yourself, because you may see somebody, you in the general sense of the word, you may see somebody who looks like somebody that was in the past, and you get this reaction, this unconscious reaction that will trigger an emotion, good or bad, whatever the case may be. And we're living in the past. We're not living in the now. Or we see something and we forecast the future and then we protect ourselves. And it, realistically, there are people out there that remind us of things. And when they remind us of things, we crawl into that pattern and that behavior.
Well, there you go. You're talking about behavior. But if you really look at what drives the behavior, Michael, is emotion. We are a product of our emotions. And our lives are a series of emotions. And just like if you had a date with your high school sweetheart, and she wore a certain kind of perfume that every time you smelled, you had a reaction. And after so many years, and you happen to date somebody who happens to be wearing the same kind of perfume, whether she is good or bad or ugly, you're going to have an immediate reaction. Why? Because of the emotion that recalls that time of your life. You can't get away from your feelings because you are your feelings.
So, sure, but you're catching past, Simon, present, to make a distinction.
Future, everything is happening here and the now. So life is happening here and the now. You have to deal with your world in this moment. That's true.
Well, no, I completely agree to that. But it's making the distinctions whether it was then or whether it was now. There's that old adage that, you know, smiling or laughter is the best medicine. And I have found over the years that if I start to get upset, I'll do one of two things. I run down into the I have a gym downstairs, and there's Barney the beat-up bag, and we'll go a couple of rounds, and it's his job to get hit, so it's safe, I'm safe, and he loves it, all right. But the other thing is, too, every once in a while, if I feel myself upset about something or someone, I'll imagine one of the dogs or the cats in this cute little dumb pose, and I can feel my chemistry change. And we can control these things. That's simple if we know how to do it.
True. One thing that people don't understand, we accumulate feelings over time. So sometimes something little or something simple that happens and you have a huge reaction, or you become you get out of control, or you end up raging over something very silly, and people say, what's wrong with you? Why are you reacting like this? Is because you may be reacting to maybe 15 million things that you piled up in your past. But the most important thing is you cannot help the way you feel. And the biggest mistake people make is they try to control what they feel. And I tell them that's wrong. You can never stop the way you feel. But, in fact, God gave you one thing that you can actually control is it's not how you feel, it is how well you deal with those feelings. That's one thing you can control.
Yeah. No question about it. I've used the example 1,000 times, but if I'm standing in the street and you walk up and smack me in the nose, I can't control that. But I can control my response, my reaction, and how I feel about it.
That's correct. It's absolutely true. But you know, people walk with a chip on their shoulder, and they really don't know how to master their feelings because they never learn how. Or they kind of dissociate it from them, so they think through everything. The life becomes about pure logic. They try to make some sense of it. But you know, the feelings are the way they are. When they speak, we are compelled to listen. They have a language of their own. But most people fail to listen. They rather think and try to reason and try to make some sense of it. And the more you think, the more you analyze, the more you lose yourself into it.
Okay, now let me ask you this. Simon, I pick up Secrets to Emotional Wealth, Follow Your Yellow Brick Road. What's it going to show me to do? What am I going to learn, discover in it that'll cause me to move in a different direction with my emotions?
Well, one thing I want people to learn is that there are 6 core feelings. They have to understand that. There's not 25 of them. There's not 50 of them. There are 6 core feelings, and I want them to first learn. And the second step is try to relate. Try to get in touch, because many of us live out of touch, and many of us live in this external world. Just get into yourself. Identify. The minute you identify with those 6 core feelings, you become at ease. Isn't it amazing how we use the word diseased or at ease? People who are diseased are basically living outside of their body.
Simon, let me
when you learn to check in, you become more at ease, more comfortable. Number 3, then how you learn to deal with them. Do you act them out? Do you numb them? Do you forget about them? Do you reason? So you learn effective tools to deal with your emotions. And then not only learn that emotions happen at the time and you deal with them as it happens, you actually become a free individual, free of emotional garbage and baggage. So you don't have to drain at the end of the day and feeling beat up. And that's what the book is about.
Okay, now let me bring you back to something. Let's take one of those steps you were talking about. Oh, believe it or not, there's a big white cat sneezing right next to me. Bless you, cat. Okay. So, a practical example, somebody who's read the book, one of your patients, used one of those. How were they feeling? What was the process they used, and how did they come out of it?
So what is your question?
Okay. An example of, let's say, some of the things that you just said.
Yes. Of
one of your patients or someone who's read the book that was having some emotional problems and used some of the things that you just referred, what you recommended, and how it turned them around. What did they do practically?
Okay, I'll give you a great example. This just happened 2 days ago in a session. I'm working with actually a physician who is very reactive to her husband. And I told her, you have a problem with anger. She realized. Initially, she didn't, because she thought it was normal, because she comes from an Italian family, so she always yelled and screamed. And I said, what happens to you every time you feel angry? She said, I just get afraid. And she never realized that. It is the fear that made her actually rage. The minute she realized and understood where her fears are coming from, her reactions have changed almost immediately. So she's now able to sit down, actually talk to her husband without raging, humiliating him, and belittling him. Actually, she is able to share herself and invite him to talk to her openly.
So there's one of the most important things in the book, seeing something you didn't see before. It's not so much what you didn't know, it's what you didn't know you didn't know to allow you to move into a particular place. That's why I think those methods are great. But, you know, and just as you said, how do they work with the individual in actual circumstances to get a feel of what's going on? I think most people have problems, and those problems is not that they don't want to get rid of them or wouldn't be it wouldn't work on getting rid of them. It's the process and the steps to get rid of them and then work on a problem you have instead of the one that you don't have.
It's true. Many, many people are focused on the issues, on the problems. So when they sit down, and you see this quite often among couples, they sit down and bicker and argue over and over, and they can't seem to resolve. At the end of an argument, of course, they're feeling more angry, more distant, more resentful. So I tell people, look, the problem is a response to what's happening to you. Get to the bottom of it. Because understanding a problem is only the gateway to the feelings. Feelings where the problem is solved.
Now, by the way, I don't think it could have been said any better in any way, shape, or form. Simon, do you have a... We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Of course. You can find me at www.emotionalmasteryinternational.com.
Wonderful. Simon, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and there's some really spot-on things that you've said.
Pleasure for having me on. Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the maker. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtains fall. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends.